The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Lots to get to on today's program. Coming up in the final segment, hungering for righteousness. We've talked so much of late about just having a hunger for knowledge, righteous knowledge in general, history, things of that nature as well. But certainly, if we're living according to the ways of the Bible, that is righteousness, and we have to hunger for it. We really have to have, like Jesus said, a hunger and a thirst for God's way of life. We'll cover that and also play a pretty inspiring soundbite from Herbert Armstrong coming up later in the show. We'll also talk a little bit more about Adam Schiff's surveillance state. We touched on this yesterday. It's not getting nearly enough coverage. Not what it should be getting, or at least if it's covered, well, it's covered in the wrong way. The media, the impeachment media, if we can call them that, they're trying to make the phone calls or the records of those phone calls, the fact that Nunes called whoever, Giuliani called whoever, they're trying to make that the scandal, when the scandal is the fact that Adam Schiff is issuing subpoenas to AT&T to get the phone records of the president's attorney. Yeah, that's straight out of Barack Obama's playbook. If we need to spy even on members of the press, John Solomon's lumped in as well. You've got an attorney for the White House, for the president. You've got a congressman, and then you've got a reporter. All of these people that Adam Schiff hates. And so, yeah, it's nothing for him to dig up dirt on those individuals. And AT&T, they're quite happy to help. Well, I'll get to that later. I guess I'm already getting to it. That's coming up in just a bit. We'll talk also about Israel's version of the deep state and the laughable offer that they've made to Prime Minister Netanyahu. Also, Attorney General Barr, he's given another speech, and as is often the case, there's always some good nuggets from a Barr speech as he is talking this time around about law enforcement, and it's a very different tone, a very different message than what we were accustomed to hearing 4, 5, 6 years ago. So all of that and more coming up on today's program. Well, the headline at the New York Times, above the fold, this is this morning's newspaper of record. Scholars call Trump's actions on Ukraine an impeachable abuse of power. The scholars have weighed in. The scholars tell us that he should be impeached. And notice the Times calls them scholars. It doesn't say left-wing academics. It doesn't say Democrat activists, even though that's what they were or are, at least three of them. You look into some of the background of these so-called scholars or experts. Pamela Carlin, she's got all of the credentials academically. Professor at Stanford. She graduated Yale. She worked for the Department of Justice under Barack Obama in 2014 and 15, and she was on, I think, a relatively short list of Barack Obama's potential Supreme Court nominees. So she could have made it to the Supreme Court under the Obama administration. Here's a little bit from Pamela Carlin. She's one of the ones who testified yesterday in the impeachment hearings. She knows nothing about the call, the evidence, the facts. She's just a scholar. testifying of her opinion. That was yesterday. Well, 13 or so years ago, this was what she was saying back in 2006, clip six.
We have to seize back the high ground on patriotism and on love of our country because we have more reason than they do to love America. The rich, pampered, prodigal, sanctimonious, incurious, white, straight sons of the powerful do pretty well everywhere in the world, and they always have. But what about us? Snarky, bisexual, Jewish women who want the freedom to say what we think, read what we want, and love whom we do.
That's the snarky, bisexual Jewish woman, as she described herself. And now she's testifying that Donald Trump should be impeached. In 2006, she talked about rich, white, straight men as being the problem. She talked about we versus they. It's us versus them. This is Pamela Carlin, who gets up there yesterday. She drags the president's son, his young son, into it, as you probably read. And she was rebuked for that, but you'll hear that in just a moment. But here, this is one of the witnesses in an impeachment hearing as to whether the president of the United States should be impeached. Noah Feldman, he's another one. He writes for Bloomberg as an opinion columnist. He, too, graduated from all the schools you would expect, Harvard, Oxford, Yale. He has recently talked about the fact that Democrats should go forward with impeachment even if there is no evidence of an indictable crime. Can you believe this? Even if there's no evidence. This is what the scholar has to say. Even if you can't find evidence, I mean, it's obvious he's in his office, the presidential office. He's obviously doing it for private gain. So you've got to impeach him. You've got to kick him out. A month or two ago, he sat down with Walter Isaacson, the historian at CNN, and here's what he had to say. Clip eight.
You wrote recently that this Constitution of ours can pass a stress test. You said it is going to be able to make it. Are you starting to worry?
It's definitely the moment in the stress test, and I think that stress test began the night that Donald Trump was elected, where you think to yourself, how's the patient doing right around now? You know, do we need to call in the EMTs?
It all started on the night he was elected. That's when we needed, that's when the United States and the Constitution, all of the founding institutions, that's when it went on life support. That's when we had to call in the EMTs. Just like we've noted before, the impeachment, the talk of impeachment, it started even before he was inaugurated. It actually started the night he was elected, November of 2016. According to Professor Feldman, America needed emergency medical attention the night 63 million Americans voted in Donald Trump. Feldman recently wrote this. He said, House Democrats will shift this week from closed-door evidence. He wrote this about a month ago. In the lead up to the Schiff hearings. Now it's over to Nadler's committee. But ahead of the Schiff committee, he says House Democrats will shift this week from closed-door evidence gathering to public impeachment hearings against President Trump. The single most dangerous pitfall they face is allowing too much legal talk to obfuscate the fundamental wrongness of Trump's conduct. So he's coaching the Democrats here a bit in this piece for Bloomberg. And he's saying, look, don't get caught up in too much legal talk because fundamentally, we all know he's wrong. Fundamentally, we all know he needs to be impeached. He says, tactically, Democrats need to avoid legalism in impeachment because too much discussion of legal rules will give Trump's defenders the chance to change the whole sordid Ukraine affair into a lawyerly argument about whether the inherent authority of the presidency allows a president to do whatever he wants in dealing with foreign countries. And so Mr. Feldman said, look, don't get too caught up into the law, because we all know about his fundamental wrongness, or the fundamental wrongness of his conduct. So these are the so-called experts brought in front of this committee. It's frightening, really, to think about these academics. These are the ones we turn to for instruction on America's founding documents. And of course, as was brought out by numerous sources yesterday, of course, all of them, all four of them, they had nothing to do with the circumstance in question, the phone call, what President Trump said or didn't say. Of course, the transcript is out there, as we well know. The July 25th phone call. This is Representative Matt Gaetz. I think he's from Florida, and he's scolding Pamela Carlin because she referenced the president's youngest son earlier in her testimony. But after the scolding, then he goes on and basically says, all right, let's see what you four have to offer in the way of evidence or facts. Here's clip two.
Now, let me also suggest that when you invoke the president's son's name here, when you try to make a little joke out of referencing Barron Trump, that does not lend credibility to your argument. It makes you look mean. It makes you look like you're attacking someone's family, the minor child of the president of the United States. So let's see if we can get into the facts. To all of the witnesses, if you have personal knowledge of a single material fact in the Schiff report, please raise your hand. And let the record reflect, no personal knowledge of a single fact. And you know what? That continues on the tradition that we saw from Adam Schiff, where Ambassador Taylor could not identify an impeachable offense. Mr. Kent never met with the president. Fiona Hill never heard the president reference anything regarding military aid. Mr. Hale was unaware of any nefarious activity with aid. Colonel Vindman even rejected the new Democrat talking point that bribery was invoked here. Ambassador Volker denied that there was a quid pro quo, and Mr. Morrison said there was nothing wrong on the call. The only direct evidence came from Gordon Sondland, who spoke to the President of the United States, and the president said, I want nothing. No quid pro quo.
That's Representative Gaetz giving a summary of what we've seen over the past several weeks. Nothing. Nothing. And these four had nothing to offer in the way of personal knowledge about material facts regarding the Schiff report. The report that Adam Schiff released, I think it was on Tuesday night. Three of these four scholars invited by the Democrats. One of them, Jonathan Turley, he was invited by the Republicans. He voted, though, for Hillary Clinton as well. So they're all Democrats. But at least Turley has enough sense to know that this is not constitutional, what they're doing. What the Democrats are doing. It's not constitutional. He says one can oppose President Trump's policies, which he certainly does. And he made a point of saying that multiple times yesterday. But he said, one can oppose President Trump's policies or actions, but still conclude that the current legal case for impeachment is not just woefully inadequate, but in some respects, dangerous. He says it's dangerous. Listen to a few of the statements that Mr. Turley made yesterday, clip one.
I'm concerned about lowering impeachment standards to fit a paucity of evidence and an abundance of anger. I believe this impeachment not only fails to satisfy the standard of past impeachments, but would create a dangerous precedent for future impeachments. If you impeach a president, if you make a high crime and misdemeanor out of going to the courts, it is an abuse of power. It's your abuse of power. You're doing precisely what you're criticizing the president for doing. We have a third branch that deals with conflicts of the other two branches. And what comes out of there and what you do with it is the very definition of legitimacy. If you accept all of their presumptions, it would be obstruction. But impeachments have to be based on proof, not presumptions. That's the problem when you move towards impeachment on this abbreviated schedule. This would be the first impeachment in history where there would be considerable debate, and in my view, not compelling evidence of the commission of a crime. Second is the abbreviated period of this investigation, which is problematic and puzzling. This is a facially incomplete and inadequate record in order to impeach a president.
It's a montage there of Jonathan Turley, one of the four scholars who doesn't agree with this, who says it's not constitutional, who, as you just saw there, if you watch the video feed, he looked at the Democrats and said, look, you're doing precisely what you accuse the president of doing. You're guilty of an abuse of power. You're guilty of what you're accusing him of doing. Look at Adam Schiff and the phone records. They go on and on about Trump and his people being in cahoots with the Russians. First the Russians, now the Ukrainians. And then here comes these surveillance state tactics. Adam Schiff sending a subpoena to AT&T, and AT&T could have fought it in the courts. They didn't do it. They issue this weak statement saying that, well, you know, we have to answer to the subpoena. And of course, when the subpoena, the Republicans were made aware of it back when everything was supposed to be kept secret, so they couldn't even kick up a fuss then. It just shows up in the report as it appears on Tuesday. Right there in all the fine print at the end of the report. Digging up dirt. Or what they say is dirt. It's just the metadata. There's no actual conversations. But the media take it and run with it. Devin Nunes called Giuliani? This is serious. This is a serious crime. John Solomon? Well, he was the one writing about all those conspiracy theories regarding Ukraine, say the Democrats. Now, that sounds fishy. And the media have no problem. He's one of their own, John Solomon. He's a reporter. And where are they in the media saying, look, you can't just pull up our phone records? They barely kicked up a fuss when Barack Obama was doing it with, 20 AP reporters? Cheryl Atkinson? James Rosen? James Risen from the New York Times? Yeah, they were just spying on all those reporters. That was standard practice for the Obama people, the Obama DOJ. And here's Adam Schiff. He hardly misses a beat. AT&T, we need the phone records on Devin Nunes, my colleague in the congressional committee here. We also need the phone records on the president's personal attorney. And then also we need it on one of the members of the media, John Solomon. We got to pull up all those records. Kim Strassel, who writes at the Wall Street Journal, she said, still waiting for my fellow members of the media to express their deep outrage and alarm that Intelligence Chair Schiff snooped through and published phone records of a member of the free press. I'm waiting. She says, I'm waiting for members of the media to express any kind of concern. John Solomon, he's one of the ones they pulled up metadata on. It says here, he tweeted, Adam Schiff arbitrarily releases my phone records as a First Amendment protected reporter. State Department bureaucrats reportedly monitored my social media. A witness gratuitously drags a 13-year-old boy into the impeachment. Whatever happened to civil liberties, privacy, and decency? That's John Solomon. And then Rudy Giuliani for his part. He tweeted it out as well. You're taking away. Well, he just gave a summary of everything that they've done. The tactics of these Democrats. All of this evil. Guilty of the very things they're accusing this president of doing. The Wall Street Journal editorial board, they weighed in. Not nearly enough. Not nearly. There should be a lot more weighing in with columns like this. And the Journal editorial board, it's not like they're big fans of President Trump. But it says here, Democrats are trying to convince Americans that President Trump should be ousted for trying to dig up dirt on a rival. They'd have more credibility if they didn't abuse their surveillance powers for drive-by smears of Republicans and a free press. It's right out of Obama's playbook, as I said. It says here, the press is playing this as if the calls are a new part of the scandal. But the real outrage here is Mr. Schiff snooping on political opponents. See, he snoops, and then the press, they take their cue, and they run with it and say, oh, well, the phone calls, that's scandalous. They don't know what was said on the calls. It's just the fact that Nunes, on three occasions, I think it was, that he would call Rudy Giuliani. They know, you see, they can assign motivation. They can divine it. They know it's evil. They know that if there was communication, any communication, that it was evil. See, they know. They knew the night he was elected that all the founding documents of the United States, that the United States itself was on life support. Pretty scary. What would have been kept under wraps, as my father has said before, had Hillary Clinton won the election in November of 2016? The Journal editorial board says here, this is unprecedented and looks like an abuse of government surveillance authority for partisan gain. Democrats were caught using the Steele dossier to coax the FBI into snooping on the 2016 Trump campaign. Now we have elected members of Congress using secret subpoenas to obtain and then release to the public the call records of political opponents. Look at what's happening here. Look at what they're doing. And what did Turley say? Well, you're doing precisely what you accused this president of doing. That's the real scandal here. It says Mr. Schiff's metadata disclosures hardly bear on his impeachment case. Mr. Giuliani had broadcast to the world that he wanted Ukraine to investigate Hunter and Joe Biden. But he's also Mr. Trump's personal attorney. Does Mr. Schiff have a legal opinion saying he could ignore attorney-client privilege? Is there such a thing as attorney-client privilege when it's President Trump in office? Because we sure heard a lot about that when Barack Obama was in office. Those attorneys surrounding him were untouchable. They were untouchable. But now we've got the phone records of one of the president's attorneys. It says Mr. Schiff's accusations against Mr. Nunes are even more suspect. The Democrat doesn't know the content of Mr. Nunes' conversations, and the Republican says he believes his spring talks with Mr. Giuliani related to the Mueller report. Mr. Nunes can speak to whomever he likes, and Mr. Schiff has no authority to investigate fellow members. Since Mr. Schiff is going to release the call logs of Republicans, can we see the logs of his calls with the impeachment press? This is what we'll never see. All of the members of the media that Adam Schiff has called to leak exactly the information he wanted out there so as to frame the narrative just so. It says the press corps might also notice that Mr. Schiff's targets include one of their own, Mr. Solomon, who was until recently a columnist at The Hill. The media usually condemn government officials who use surveillance to track the and intimidate the media. But here they are cheering Mr. Schiff on. See, usually they're just appalled by this kind of behavior. They're blowing the whistle. They're saying to government officials, who are you to intimidate members of the media? Well, they're fine with it, as we've reported before. All through the Obama administration, they went right after whistleblowers, leakers, spied on members of the media, and the media did nothing. The media just dutifully submitted to Barack Obama. Ben Rhodes would go out and mock them, tell them how stupid they are, tell the whole world how easy it was to deceive the media. They'd come out of Columbia Law School or journalism school, and they didn't know anything about world events. And so they were just so easily manipulated. And nobody said anything. Nobody protested, for the most part. This column, finally, it says, Mr. Schiff's extraordinary and secret plunge into metadata, followed by its gratuitous public disclosure, is one more example of the partisan score settling that motivates this impeachment exercise. It says, in the cause of impeaching Donald Trump, anything goes. Anything goes. Well, my father has written before about this president getting better control of his divided government. That's in the August issue of the Trumpet magazine. I just want to say a few things here about this offer coming from Israel's deep state, if we can call it that. Yesterday, they offered, I think it was the president of Israel, Channel 12 is reporting that he said if Netanyahu was willing to resign as prime minister and to leave public life or political life completely and confess his crimes, if he was willing to confess his crimes and leave office, then the Israeli president might be willing to pardon him. What a sweet deal. Look, if you tell the world you're a crook and you get out of office, then we might pardon you. I mean, doesn't that in itself, that offer, doesn't it show that it's just a political hit job? All they want is for him to be out of office. They're not seriously trying to get him on these so-called crimes. They just want him gone. It's just like that statement from the professor, you know, the scholar who said about Donald Trump. Well, we just know. We knew it the night that he came into office. You don't have to go through and find the actual laws that have been violated. You don't even need evidence of an indictable crime, really. The fundamental wrongness of Trump's conduct, it was just obvious to us from the beginning. And this is what they say about Netanyahu. Well, they can't form a coalition government over there, none of the parties. And I think some of Netanyahu's attackers have been assuming that they would be able to somehow. I don't think they want another round of elections, a third election in about a year's time, because it does give the people an opportunity to, I don't know how the Israeli people are going to vote, but it's like it's another referendum or a referendum on this attorney general's conduct, on these crimes, these so-called crimes of the prime minister. What if the Israeli electorate comes out in full force in support of Netanyahu? And he's supposed to be this criminal, according to the lawyers, according to the experts. There are some polls in Israel indicating that a lot of the public, they're not at all convinced that he's guilty of these crimes, taking bribes or whatever else it is. So it'll be interesting to see if, like we've seen in the United States, to see if their agenda is exposed. Like the farther they go into this attack on the prime minister, the more and more of the lawlessness we see behind the scenes. I've got another article here, too, about this just follows on something we talked about yesterday. Rolling Stone, the left-wing publication, why the Christian right worships Donald Trump. Here's another left-wing, just like The Atlantic, another left-wing publication waxing eloquent on religion, the Bible. It talks in the article about the return of Jesus Christ. And of course, it's anti-Trump all the way through, and it's basically saying, how could these so-called religious people lend their support to someone who's so immoral? But then it does do a pretty good job of showing how Donald Trump really has followed through with a lot of his campaign promises to the evangelicals. They voted for Mr. Trump by an 81%, or at a take of 81% of the evangelical vote. And this article says that if anything, he's going to get even more next time around, which is why they're doing anything and everything that they can to destroy him before we ever get to another election. Attorney General Barr, just one last bit here. He was at the Award for Distinguished Service earlier this week. I think it was a couple of days ago. And he basically gives a strong, hearty endorsement to law enforcement. In this first clip, actually, he's talking about the kind of respect that we have, that we've had for some time with members of the military when you see them come into airports or onto a plane or whatever. Listen to what he said about them, clip four.
And I'm very happy today when I'm at an airport and troops come through, coming back or being deployed. There's frequently everything stops and they get a round of applause because people recognize that that's the right thing to do for these people who are serving us.
It's just, it's enjoyable to listen to him. Sam was making this point this morning in our meeting, that when you hear some of the testimony yesterday from these far left-wing hacks, really, academics, scholars, and just how unhinged they are because of their hatred for Donald Trump, just like throwing a little tantrum. And then you have someone like Attorney General Barr who's just serious. I mean, he has a good sense of humor, too. We've noted that before. But he's just a serious-minded man who reveres the law. And so he would come into a proceeding like yesterday and say, all right, where are the facts? What are the charges here? And what do we have in the way of facts? But that's not how the Democrats have been operating, as you heard from Representative Gates. Every single witness has nothing to offer in terms of personal knowledge, except for one, Sondland, who testified that the president told him, I don't want a quid pro quo. Just one evidence, or sorry, one witness. And his evidence supports the president. Well, the attorney general is talking there about the respect that Americans show for members of the military, and he says it follows that it should also be that way with law enforcement, with police officers as well. And this is a very different message from what we were used to during the Obama years. Here's clip five.
But I think today American people have to focus on something else, which is the sacrifice and the service that is given by our law enforcement officers. And they have to start showing more than they do the respect and support that law enforcement deserves. And if communities don't give that support and respect, they may find themselves without the police protection they need.
Wow, that's the Attorney General of the United States saying that if we don't show more respect and support for law enforcement, then law enforcement in some of those cities that disrespect, or neighborhoods that disrespect them, they may disappear. And then you'll see what it's like without the support of law enforcement. You know, we've heard all through this yesterday in particular, here are the scholars saying, we've got to do it. We've got to uphold the law. We've got to uphold the Constitution. All of a suddenly, you've got members of the radical left who are talking nonstop about the rule of law. And yet here, right at the grassroots level, right out on the front lines, you have policemen that are upholding the rule of law. And the Attorney General says they deserve our respect and support. And if we don't give them that, well, then we might find ourselves without the police protection that we need. Back in 2015, this was following that attack on the police, just that dreadful attack in Dallas. And then we featured the police being under attack right on the cover of the, I think it was the July issue that year. And my father said as much. Law enforcement's under attack. And he talked about all these cases where people from some of these dangerous neighborhoods, instead of pointing fingers at criminals, they were wanting to point fingers at police. He said, you need to recognize how dangerous these trends are, my father said. I mean, I just want to read this so that you can see the contrast between what it was like in the previous administration and what you heard earlier this week with the Attorney General's speech, or that clip I just played for you. My father said, the federal government is fueling people's mistrust of their local police forces, playing up the seriousness of these problems. One reason is that this administration is positioning itself to step in and solve them while taking more power to itself. And then my father quotes Al Sharpton, who was in and out of the White House. It was like a revolving door during the Obama years. Sharpton was in there. And then when there were some of these scandalous acts that the media, well, some of it wasn't even scandal, the media just made it up. You had Sharpton and others out there saying that the Department of Justice needs to step in and take over policing the country. They wanted the DOJ to have that power, even at the local level, to intervene and to take over law enforcement, because you couldn't trust the police. That was the message. That was the message in 2015. My father said, they're tearing down the police, the nation's last line of defense. Now you have, during this temporary resurgence, now you have an attorney general out there who's building it back up. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Freedom is one of the most sought-after ideals in human history. Man's search for freedom has taken him into the fiercest of protests, struggles, revolutions, civil wars, and even world wars. Today, in the midst of free societies, many continue to fight for what they perceive as ever greater freedoms. And yet, many of these same people are actively fighting against law. Few people understand that this war against law actually undermines true freedom. To learn more, request Gerald Fleury's booklet, No Freedom Without Law. In this free booklet, you will see what the Bible says about the latter-day spirit of rebellion and lawlessness that is now so common in our nations today. Also request America Under Attack. In this booklet, you will learn more about the spirit behind this attack on law. You'll see where this is leading. Both booklets are offered freely at no cost or obligation to you. Request No Freedom Without Law and America Under Attack. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
In Matthew chapter 5, Jesus said, "Blessed are they which do hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled." They will be filled. They will be satisfied. That hunger, that thirst will be satisfied. If you hunger for righteousness, if you hunger for right doing, right behavior, the right way to live, Herbert Armstrong had something to say about that hunger, even in the last year of his life. He was 93 years old at the time, and thinking about how hungry he was after devoting his life, a 50-year-plus ministry, devoting his life to God, and yet he was working even up to the very last day to grow. I touched on this yesterday with the example that he set and just the work that he produced in those last 8-10 years of his life, even into his 80s and 90s. Mystery of the Ages, of course, being the crowning achievement of his 50-year ministry, written in the last year of his life. Well, here's what Mr. Armstrong said in April of 1985. This was less than a year before he died, clip 7.
In the last year or more, I've been especially concerned about the passage of Scripture that talks of hungering and thirsting for God's righteousness. I began to wonder, did I really hunger and thirst for it? I knew I ought to want to have God's righteousness. And I had to really stop to think and begin to pray about it before I began to really, and I thought I had, but I hadn't really hungered and thirsted for it. I want God's righteousness. Now, if you can understand, you will too.
That's from April of 1985, one of my favorite clips from Mr. Armstrong. He went on to describe God's character, God's righteousness. He talked about how God doesn't suffer. He doesn't have any fears. He doesn't sorrow, except when, you know, we bring it on him. But Mr. Armstrong described a God who has no aches or pains. And he mentioned how God is just full of perfect righteousness. He is perfect, vibrant health. He overflows with joy, with happiness and goodness. And in describing that perfect character, Mr. Armstrong then said, "Now, that's something to really hunger and thirst for, to be righteous like God is righteous, to be blessed with joy and with peace, with happiness and goodness, with contentment." That's what conversion in God's church is all about, coming out of this world and the ways of this world and living, like it says in Galatians 2, unto God, being a living sacrifice for God. Again, yesterday, you'll remember Mr. Armstrong said, "I don't know how long I'm going to live. I just know that I belong to God, and it's up to Him. He decides. I know that as long as I'm here to serve Him." As long as we're here to hunger and thirst for God's righteousness. And if we do, it's not only going to be satisfied or filled, as Jesus said, we're really going to reap such wonderful blessings from God, even in this life. John 10 and verse 10. Jesus came so that we could have an abundant life, so that we could live the abundant life. But think about the aches and the pains and the harm, the frustrations, the worries, the fears. Think about what we so often bring on ourselves because of sin, because of mistakes. Cause and effect. If the marriage doesn't work, if the child rearing isn't working, there's a cause, there's a reason. Notice John 6, this is verse 35. It says, "And Jesus said unto them, I am the bread of life. He that comes to me shall never hunger, and he that believes on me shall never thirst." If we go to Jesus Christ, if we claim that blood sacrifice and then turn to God in repentance and hunger for righteousness, the Bible says we're never going to hunger. We'll never thirst. Verse 48 says, "I am that bread of life. Your fathers did eat manna in the wilderness and are dead." The Israelites of old, they ate physical manna from heaven and they eventually died. That didn't sustain them forever. But Christ here in John 6 is talking about spiritual manna. And the fact that we're going to live forever with God in His kingdom. This physical life is just a stepping stone, a launch pad, a training ground. Verse 50 says, "This is the bread which comes down from heaven, that a man may eat thereof and not die." See, never die. Live forever. Verse 51 continues, "I am the living bread which came down from heaven. If any man eat of this bread, he shall live forever. And the bread that I will give is my flesh, which I will give for the life of the world." The Jews therefore strove among themselves, saying, "How can this man give us his flesh to eat?" And then Jesus said to them, "Verily, verily, I say unto you, except you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you have no life in you. Whoso eats my flesh and drinks my blood has eternal life, and I will raise him up at the last day. For my flesh is meat indeed, and my blood is drink indeed. He that eats my flesh and drinks my blood dwells in me, and I in him." So every year, when you observe the Passover service the way that God says to, and he lays out instructions for us on that in 1 Corinthians 11 and elsewhere, but we are symbolically, we're taking that broken bread, we're consuming that little glass of wine, and communicating to the Father that we hunger and we thirst for righteousness. Of course, we're accepting that shed blood and that broken body sacrifice so that we might be healed, so that we might be saved. But we're also saying we're really hungry for Christ to live in us, 1 John 4, 1 and 2. For Christ and his mind to come into our minds, Philippians 2 and verse 5. Verse 57 here, it says, "As the living Father has sent me, and I live by the Father, so he that eats me, even he shall live by me." So Christ is saying, here's what I mean about eating my flesh and drinking my blood. It's living by me. It's following in my steps. 1 Peter 2:21. Following in the steps of Jesus Christ, getting to really know God, hungering for God's way, hungering for his righteousness, hungering for his mindset. I've used this quote before with college classes. It's from an old book about, well, it's about reading. And the guy's point here is this author is that you get to know someone in your day-to-day life by conversing with them, spending time with them. And he was just making the point that you can do the same thing with someone of old by just reading and studying everything about their life, like we've done with Winston Churchill. We have a class on Winston Churchill, and he's been dead over 50 years. We have a class on Herbert Armstrong. He's been dead over 30 years. Of course, everyone that we study in the Bible has been dead for thousands of years. But by studying God's word, we can actually consume Jesus Christ. The Bible is the word of Jesus Christ. It's Jesus Christ in print. So this author here, he says, in ordinary life, what would we do if we wished to know a man more thoroughly? We would, if possible, live beside him and associate with him. We would notice his appearance, his dress, his house, his everyday habits. We would study his demeanor in all the varying scenes of life, in joy and in sorrow, beside his friends and in the presence of his enemies. And we would listen to all his sayings, his careless conversation by the fireside, and his deliberate utterances before the public. And last of all, we would place ourselves in imagination in his circumstances and look at things from his point of view. It's a valuable lesson. We were talking in our Scrum meeting this morning about this article by Andrew Roberts. It was actually in the stack of news yesterday. It's taken from his book, Walking with Destiny, the one about Winston Churchill. But the point made in this short excerpt is that Churchill was, when he was in the wilderness years, during the 1930s, he was writing this, I think it's a 6-volume set on his great ancestor, Lord Marlborough. And Andrew Roberts says that this was really helpful, this research, this study, this writing. Churchill was immersed into it right in the middle of the 1930s, even as Hitler was on the rise. Even as Churchill was preparing to step into office in 1940, Roberts says writing about Marlborough really prepared Churchill for what he was about to face. It prepared him because he was learning everything that he could about Marlborough. And the lesson that this author makes about reading and studying books is that you can get to know someone intimately the more you just immerse yourself into their life. Verse 58 says, "This is that bread which came down from heaven, not as your fathers did eat manna, but and are dead rather. He that eats of this bread shall live forever." See, if we consume this, if we get in there and get to know God the Father and Jesus Christ just as thoroughly as we can. We want to be beside them. We want to associate with them. We notice everything about their appearance, so to say. The dress, the house, the everyday habits, the demeanor, the varying scenes of life. That's who we're getting to know. If we're hungering and thirsting for righteousness, because they live righteously. They're perfect in character. And to the extent that we obey the laws that they gave to us for our own good, for our own benefit, we can be more like them. 1 John 2 and verse 3, "Hereby we know, we do know that we know him if we keep his commandments." We know God. If we're obeying God, if we're keeping his commandments, verse 4 of that same chapter, this is 1 John 2, it says, he that says, I know him and keeps not his commandments is a liar, and the truth is not in him. But whoso keeps his word, in him verily is the love of God perfected. Hereby know we that we are in him. He that says he abides in him ought himself also so to walk, even as he walked. We walk in his steps. We follow in his steps. This is what we hunger and thirst for. And Mr. Armstrong, as you heard, he had that hunger even up right into his last year on earth. It's a great example for the rest of us. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Don't forget to email the program, td@kpcg.fm. Thanks for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.